This is a special edition of Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the premier financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Now, for this special edition of Macro Voices, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Macro Voices All-Stars episode number 27 was recorded on July 2nd, 2019. I'm Eric Townsend. All-Star Dr. Pippa Malmgren is back with us today for another fantastic interview. This episode of Macro Voices All-Stars is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, the leading podcast for systematic trading and investing. They're even offering Macro Voices listeners a free book. I'll tell you how to claim it at the end of this episode. Pippa, it is so great to have you back on All-Stars. We had originally hoped to have you last week, and you had some travel, and we missed you. So it's great to have you back. Oh, I've got a question that I know everybody's dying to get your take on, because you've actually worked in the White House and understand this process. President Trump, okay, suddenly we've got this unplanned, unexplained little field trip to the North Korean DMZ, and a restarting of trade talks with China, which has been on again, off again about 20 times. It feels to me like this is all, you know, produced like a movie, that this is theatrics with President Trump's followers and supporters need to be shown that he's a tough negotiator, and they've seen that now, and now he's going to pull the deal together and it's going to be great. Is this stuff being produced like Hollywood? I'm sure when you worked in the White House, you were never a party to anything like that. But it feels to me like the current administration is kind of producing the news ahead of time.
Well, actually, to be fair, all presidents engage in Hollywood-like preparations and theatrics when they go abroad. And pretty much most presidents do this in the second half of their first term, because usually they lose control of the Congress, which is exactly what's happened here. And so Trump is going to go overseas, because it doesn't matter whether he goes to Paris or he goes to the DMZ, you get fantastic pictures and press control and control of the narrative when you go overseas as president. But this particular event is super interesting in my view, because, you know, I've argued for a long time that he wants for his Wikipedia entry, and Xi Jinping also wants for his Wikipedia entry, that these are the two men that permitted a normalization of the relationship between North and South Korea, and a diminishment, if not an entire removal, of the nuclear threat on the Korean Peninsula. And so, I've long argued that the way Trump and Xi are negotiating is that they want this deal, but they'll use anything to get there, including discussions about trade and discussions about Huawei and discussions about the South China Sea and discussions even about Iran. And so all of it is aimed at, can we get to a place where there's a deal announced on the Korean Peninsula being normalized? Because that's such an epic historic event. It's worth it for both of these leaders. And so I keep thinking they are edging closer to a deal. Yes, it gets noisy and they fall into squabbles now and again, but the Chinese recognize that this deal is not going to be on the table or on offer the next president who comes into power. This is a Trump exclusive, one-time only deal. And so I still think that's what we're edging toward. And how fascinating that even when there's a hint of success, the markets go through the roof. And I keep saying, you know, all they have to do is exchange packs of bubble gum and the stock markets are going to rally extraordinarily. So the risk here for markets is all upside risk, not downside risk. One other thing that I think is super important is the relationship between the Saudis and the president. And again, we have a president who, like I keep saying, you know, all presidents want to have the Wikipedia entry, and having a confrontation with Iran would certainly be in that Wikipedia entry. And we just happen to have this interesting alignment right now between both the Israelis and the Saudis, both of whom would very much welcome a confrontation with Iran. You know, we've recently seen the news that the Saudis have become the biggest buyers of U.S. treasuries. So I'm just a little bit keeping an eye on that relationship and how deeply intertwined the two seem to be. And I just think everybody's been all focused on the relationship between President Trump and President Putin, but a lot less focus on the Saudi relationship. And I just think that's all tied up as well with this question of whether there's going to be conflict with regard to Iran.
Let's go a little further on that subject of Iran and that conflict. It seems to me like John Bolton wants to have a war. If I'm, you know, you're the expert on this, Pippa, I'm just an amateur, but it feels to me like President Trump is looking at this thing saying, wait a minute, in an election year, do I really want to get into this? Probably not. And it seems to me like maybe we're starting to see a de-escalation where this whole thing is going to calm down. Again, I'm an amateur. What do you think? Am I on the right track?
I'm not sure that that works, actually, that logic that you don't want to have confrontation during an election. The reality is every time that Trump is tough on foreign policy, actually, he's got a big support base for that. Being able to have events that then he can respond to is actually useful going into the election. And let's face it, look at the amount of money that he is raising. I mean, it's just extraordinary. I think he did $25 million in a single day at one event and has already raised over $100 million. I mean, the numbers are astonishing and really put American politics on a completely different financial foundation than we've ever seen for any prior election. I mean, the scale of money that one has to raise now is so off the chart. So I don't know. To say that it doesn't help his cause, I'm not sure that's right.
I want to shift gears, Pippa, to a completely different subject. Just a couple of weeks ago, Facebook announced that they are launching a new digital currency system. Now, on the surface, it's just trying to make the world a better place, thanks to Facebook giving you great technology. I spent an entire 45 minutes debunking that idea with my own video, which for anybody who's interested, it's at macrovoices.com. But I want to get your take, not just on Facebook, but you know, you're really good at expanding these issues and putting them in context of a bigger picture. What's going on in your perspective with Facebook's Libra currency, but also how does it fit into the bigger picture of personal privacy rights and so forth on the internet?
There's this huge battle going on, and it's very odd because the public is almost unaware of this battle. It's the people who really have a front seat view of the most valuable commodity in the world now, which is data. They are coming out and saying either we need to do something to protect human beings from the random use of their data by people who are either trying to control them or sell to them, or and the people who love the fact that there are no rules, no laws, it's a wide open Wild West, and you can not only get all this data for nothing, but you can package it and repackage it and sell it without ever having to confer with who gave it to you in the first place. So I'm particularly drawn to this guy, Larry Sanger. He was one of the original founders of Wikipedia alongside Jimmy Wales. And Larry Sanger has come out with this declaration of digital independence. And he's called for a social media strike on the 4th of July. And when you read what he says, he basically says human beings should be entitled to surf around on the net without being accountable for what they've been looking for and having that data not only sold to companies trying to sell to them, but the HR department of companies that potentially are going to employ them. Because that's exactly what's happening, is that the people buying the data are the ones that might employ you, the ones that might sell you insurance, and they want to know, what kind of a person is this? And I'm not talking about stuff like pornography. You know, I can see the reasons why you might have a regulatory environment around that. I'm talking about you are ordering Ben and Jerry's ice cream on a Thursday night at midnight, and this is taken to be a sign that you're emotionally unstable, and that shows up on your HR application. Before they even look at your resume, they've already decided, you know, statistically speaking, we think people who do this are unlikely to be, you know, good workers in this company. And suddenly you just never get the phone call. And so what Larry Sanger is saying is human beings are entitled to, first of all, not have their data used by everybody else without them knowing. And second, they should be entitled to get paid something if that is going to be for sale. And all of that then takes me to the Libra issue, which is that's a bit like the WeChat platform in China, which is like WhatsApp, except it adds payments. Now, in China, the government uses WeChat to track every single citizen, what you say, who you talk to, what you're focused on, everything. Your physical movements are tracked. And it becomes a way, if they don't want you to move from A to B because you've been behaving badly, then you can't use the payments mechanism. They connect it to all of your data. So you try to take a train, you can't board a train. And so it becomes part of creating a digital prison. Well, in the West, we've been doing this and scoring our citizens. We just privatize the function. So it happens at Amazon and Uber and, you know, Facebook. Well, now Facebook has announced Libra. Libra is a number of things. One of them is it's a payments platform that allows the company to then really track what you're doing and when and where and with whom. But it's also a mechanism for vastly increasing the power of Facebook because it becomes, you know, just a good solid payments transactions base. Now, I understand why that's smart from a equity point of view, equity valuation point of view, but it's really interesting whether we want to give Facebook not only everything we already do, but in addition, show them outright every single transaction we're engaged in, and then let them sell that data to the world and then not get any compensation for it. And so this is why it's a much bigger issue than just Libra or just, you know, what Larry Sanger is calling for. It's really a existential issue about the most valuable commodity that any of us have on the whole planet. If this were oil, there would be companies and citizens fighting tooth and nail for control. But because it's data and people don't understand why that's valuable, everybody's just whistling and going, well, I don't know, that has nothing to do with me. So I think this is fascinating.
I think it's incredibly fascinating, Pippa. But I want to ask you about an aspect of this because it intuitively, it feels to me like, oh boy, these guys, Facebook, Google, you know, the government should do something. Well, wait a minute. The government is not on the people's side of this. Now, I know from another guest, I can't say who to respect their privacy, but someone that we know who has very high-level contacts in China has told me there is a whole team of people in China who monitor Western social media, and they blacklist anyone who criticizes Chinese policy from ever being able to receive a visa to China. The United States recently announced that anyone who wants to apply for a visa to visit the United States, any foreigner, will be required to submit, I believe it's not just your social media identity, but they want the passwords too. They want everything. So the position of the U.S. government is not, we've got to come to the defense of the people and get Facebook and Google online. It's more like, what other data do you guys have that you might give to us? So where could this be headed?
Absolutely. You're quite right. Well, that's the thing. Like now the difference between the American position and the Chinese position maybe is not so big. And I find this, again, it's like the governance issue of our time is, you know, how much privacy is a citizen entitled to? And what things might you do that would set off alarm bells for the U.S. government that you might not even be aware of? Because, you know, we live in a world today where everybody's looking for correlations between things. Like, you know, apparently if you eat blueberry yogurt, it highly correlated with being Republican. Now, it doesn't cause you to be a Republican, but the fact is the data shows that people who eat blueberry yogurt tend to vote Republican. So then the algorithm concludes that if you're buying blueberry yogurt, then you probably are, and treats you as such. Well, what other correlations are being created by the bombardment of data? And yet it's not really getting a lot of resonance, which I find, again, just fascinating that people haven't really thought about this.
Now, Pippa, I couldn't possibly agree more with the sentiment of what you said, but there's one point I want to push back on a little bit, which is you said that people are not even aware that this is happening. I would look at it a little differently. I see that people are being made aware and don't seem to care. And it seems to me that there has been some kind of social change where younger generations particularly don't feel that their privacy of their personal data is something they're terribly concerned with. I think that people my age would be offended that this data is being used in these ways. I think a lot of younger people would say, oh, it's great that governments or, you know, U.S. governments wants to know everybody's social media passwords before they'll even consider them for a visa now. That's a new rule, I believe, that the U.S. has just implemented. I think a lot of younger people think that's just fine. Is this a change in social attitude that we need to understand?
Well, I do think there are generational gaps. I think millennials think it's just fine. The Generation Z that's below them, I have a daughter who's in that age bracket, they are very uneasy about social media and their privacy. There's been a complete turnaround for the kids who are now teenagers, and they are extremely cautious and wary about participating in anything that gives away their personal information. So it's a generational thing. But I also think it's because people feel they have nothing to hide. And they're just not understanding. It's not about that. It's about if you have certain behaviors that the HR department won't even interview you. And if you were to stand there in front of them and say, well, just because I, you know, eat ice cream at midnight doesn't mean that I'm emotionally unstable. And they might say, yes, well, but our algorithm says that it is true. So we're not even going to meet you. See, this is the thing. It's the foregone opportunity that you don't even know happened.
Pippa, I hear what you say about Gen Z, and frankly, I think it's refreshing that that younger generation is maybe not going to repeat what I feel is a mistake of their older brothers and sisters in the millennial generation who were so unconcerned with the privacy of their personal data. But I guess what I still don't see is what can we expect and where is this headed? Because I don't think that governments anywhere in the world are going to change their attitude that they want to scoop as much information as they can possibly get and try to mine it as best as they know how. And frankly, for all the reasons you've described, that introduces a lot of risk of error. But I don't think it's going to change. You did describe this new internet bill of rights idea that is being introduced. You know, that sounds great. Larry Sanger, I applaud him. But, you know, I don't think that the strike on Facebook on the 4th of July is going to change the attitude of governments around the world. So where is this all headed? And what should we be doing about it?
At the core of it, this isn't a question about governance. It's about the nature of the relationship between the citizen and the state, between the company and the customer. And I think that's how we should think about it, as opposed to it being just a technical issue. It's really about the balance of power in the society. And I guess until people experience this personally, and that would mean they have to find out that the reason they never got the job, or the reason they couldn't get the insurance, or the reason that somebody wouldn't date them on the internet was because their data was available and someone made a decision on the basis of the digital twin, not on you, but your digital twin. Because see, most people don't even get to see their digital twin. They don't know what do they look like. You know, at least with Equifax, you can look at your financial position. You can say, I want to know, how do I appear? But we don't have an Equifax for all of your personal data. And frankly, algorithms and supercomputing and AI altogether are making what used to be anonymous data and discrete silos of data. Now, basically, you remove the anonymity. It's so easy to figure out who you are based on a few metrics, and suddenly you're de-anonymized. And now we know exactly you and your behavior and how you think, because it's all connected up. So I guess, I don't know, maybe people have to experience something and be shocked by that before they'll react. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, it really worries me, frankly, but, you know, I have to think, suppose that Larry Sanger has a really productive 4th of July strike or whatever, and as you described with Equifax, my understanding is that's a law, that Equifax has to disclose your credit history to you, because that's a right that you have. Suppose Larry Sanger makes a big issue of this, and there's a big push, you know, for the Larry Sanger Act, which is a new act of Congress, which requires disclosure of all personal data of yours. You know, you have a right to see what is being shown to others from anybody who's collecting it. I have a feeling that the most vocal and outspoken opponent of that would be the U.S. government, who probably feels that in the fight against terrorism, they need to be mining all this data and they don't want people to know exactly what they're doing. Am I just being paranoid to think that that would be their reaction?
Well, yeah, I think there are different parts of the U.S. government with different attitudes on to the subject, but there surely would be parts of the U.S. government that loves this incredible ability to engage in reconnaissance of private lives. But there are parts of the U.S. government that would be horrified and wanting to protect the rights of the citizen in keeping with the Constitution. So again, it's a big argument. But if you look at what Larry Sanger's calling for, you know, it's so simple. It's, he says, you know, free individuals should be able to publish our own data freely without having to answer to a corporation. That seems pretty straightforward. It should be legal to own your own data, and you should have moral rights over the control of your own data. This is not that outrageous. You should be able to engage in things like private conversations in your home without having to worry that that's being broadcast and sold to the internet. So now if you're arguing with your spouse, there's a whole bunch of organizations that start trying to sell you divorce services. I just think it's a governance question. It's not going to go away. And since so much of the value of any company today is tied up in this question, we have to study this and try to understand where is the public going? Will they just continue to ignore it? In which case, the Googles of this world are worth a lot more than they are today, or that there's going to be some kind of controls put in place, in which case Google's valuation won't be as high as it would have been otherwise. So I think this is just the super hottest issue, and every investor needs to pay attention to it, because the valuation of every single company is affected by whether we end up in a world where they get to control the data, even if it's yours, or we end up in a world where you get a say in how your data is controlled.
Pippa, we're going to have to leave it there in the interest of time, but I can't thank you enough for another fantastic interview this holiday weekend. Today's All-Stars episode with Pippa was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. If you want a different perspective on how to invest in today's markets without emotions and without predictions, go to TopTradersUnplugged.com/macro, where you can claim a free book about a highly dependable and consistent, yet frequently overlooked investment strategy. Check them out. You'll be glad you did. For the Macro Voices Podcast Network, I'm Eric Townsend.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices.